A Houston family whose photojournalist son was kidnapped in Syria nearly 4.5 years ago gets word from the White House that it's confident their son is alive. I'm Norma Martinez for Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Deborah and Mark Tice were briefed recently by James O'Brien, the presidential envoy for hostage affairs, fueling optimism that their son, Austin Tice, will eventually be released. They told Houston Public Media's Ed Mayberry that they've never had any doubt that Austin is alive and will eventually return safely. They say they're heartened that the U.S. government also seems to have the same assessment.
You know, we're in very regular contact with the special envoy and also with the hostage recovery fusion cell, both of which were established through the new hostage policy that President Obama put in place.
Explain the new hostage policy, the biggest change in the policy.
The biggest manifested change is that all the different intelligence agencies, the State Department, the FBI, the CIA, are all actually sitting in a room together, looking each other in the eye and sharing information. Another really important part of the change is a willingness to include the family of a hostage as an important part of the team, if that's what the family wants. Also, this new executive order position of special presidential envoy for hostage affairs, Jim is actually able to interface with government and speak with a voice of authority.
I know that you can't reveal all that you've learned about Austin's situation without endangering him. What can you tell us about what James O'Brien told you and told the senator? What information is new to you and continues giving you hope?
Deborah and I, our children, none of us have ever had any doubt that Austin was alive and well and will come safely home to us. But what we learned specifically is that that is also the assessment of the United States government, you know, based on things that we don't know and couldn't share if we did know. And for that reason, it's absolutely imperative that the work to get him home continues. And we're confident that that's what the United States government will do as well.
And Mark, you said at a press conference, and I guess it was quoted in Texas Monthly, that you two know that he's not being held by Islamic State terrorists or any other opposition group.
Yeah, you know, Ed, for many reasons, based on horrible experiences that people have had with ISIS and other terrorist groups, there's no evidence whatsoever to indicate that Austin is being held by ISIS or any other terrorist group.
Okay. Now, you've talked about the continuing efforts, and one of them, of course, the museum and what they've been doing with the banner. And, you know, that banner is going to be seen by the president-elect as he travels through the streets of Washington on his inauguration day.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for asking about that, Ed. It's such an uplifting thing. I had been advocating for a banner in the way that the French hang those banners on the sides of their buildings saying, you know, we do not allow our citizens to be held hostage. It's also really important, Ed, that journalists take tremendous risks. We are focused on Austin. We want to get Austin home. But his captivity is an expression of the threat to press freedom.
Thank you very much. And I hope the next time I'm talking with you, it's on the other side of good news.
Yeah, we hope so, too.
We hope so, too.
Ed, we'd be remiss if we didn't express our thanks and our gratitude, not only to people like the museum, Reporters Without Borders, but also just to all the people that have reached out to us. It's vital for us to have that support and thank everyone for the support they've given us.
That was Houston Public Media's Ed Mayberry speaking with Deborah and Mark Tice about their journalist son who was kidnapped in Syria in August of 2012. You may have heard gunshots this past New Year's Eve in what's becoming a dangerous tradition to celebrate the holiday. Houston's police chief aims to stop the practice after State Representative Armando Martinez was hit in the head by one of those stray bullets in Weslaco near the Rio Grande Valley. Houston Public Media's Al Ortiz reports Martinez survived, but celebratory gunfire can also be deadly.
Celebratory gunfire is in the news because Texas State Representative Armando Martinez was hit in the head by a stray bullet on New Year's Eve in Weslaco. Martinez survived, but he says he plans to propose legislation against this practice. That's despite the fact that discharging a firearm in a public place other than a public road or a shooting range is already illegal in the state. Recently appointed Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo patrolled the city on the last night of 2016. He didn't see any incidents, but he's determined to go after anyone who engages in that kind of activity.
In the future, we're going to deploy officers not just in black and whites looking for these people that are engaging in what I consider to be deadly conduct. We're going to actually deploy people in cool cars and cars that don't look like police cars.
Additionally, Acevedo says deployments could also take place on one of the biggest holidays of the year.
As I do some data onto how much of that goes on the 4th of July, I can assure you we're going to evolve, our methods are going to evolve, and we're going to start arresting some of these people.
On New Year's Eve 2014, a Houston man was killed by celebratory gunfire.
That was Houston Public Media's Al Ortiz reporting. Turning now to Dallas, where a new district attorney was sworn in this past week. Faith Johnson, a former prosecutor and felony court judge, is Dallas County's first African-American female DA. KERA's Bill Zeeble was at the ceremony where Johnson said she was excited and grateful to both God and Republicans for helping her break through this barrier.
A Republican prosecutor for nearly 8 years and judge for 17, she was most recently a Department of Public Safety commissioner. New DA Faith Johnson spoke of her own faith in front of a packed central jury room of about 500.
I started working before I got the appointment because by faith I just believed. I literally started closing down my office the day I submitted my application by faith.
Then Johnson promised equal justice to all. This audience knew that her predecessor, Republican Susan Hawke, resigned for health reasons, and the man Hawke defeated, Democrat Craig Watkins, left in a cloud of scandal.
I am a woman of integrity, people, and I want to maintain that integrity. I don't want to take a bribe. I don't want to do anything bad. I want to represent the people of Dallas County with integrity and justice. And fairness.
Hawke's spotty attendance, while she sought help for depression, was not lost on well-wishers. Dallas County Republican Chair Philip Huffines welcomed Johnson.
The last couple of years, it's been a little up and down, but she's going to turn the office from being inwardly focused to outwardly focused. She is committed to being present in the office of DA so that the individuals of Dallas County, the citizens of Dallas County, know that she is representing them.
Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings said Johnson would be a good partner with the city.
I love to be at places where we have breakthroughs. Today, we swear in the first female African-American district attorney.
Appointed by Governor Greg Abbott, Johnson serves through the end of 2018. She's already said she'll run again. Winning may be tough in deep blue Dallas County. Commissioner John Wiley Price, a Democrat who's backed this Republican before, says it'll come down to performance.
Governance is the only thing that matters. I think she'll do well. She just follows the governance model. And at the end of the day, that's what it's about.
How does she intend to govern? Johnson wants to open satellite offices for those who find it hard to reach the riverfront office. She also wants to start a citizen advisory committee. And Johnson vowed to maintain the integrity unit that's helped overturn a number of past convictions. For Fronteras, I'm Bill Zeeble.
Now we head to New Mexico, where there's a huge backlog of thousands of sexual assault evidence kits waiting to be tested. A recent state audit of the kits showed most of the kits have never even made it to a lab. KUNM's Marisa DeMarco reports the kits have been sitting around law enforcement departments all over the state
for decades.
The first time Captain Andy Taylor heard about thousands of forensic evidence kits from sexual assault cases not being tested by the labs was when a public records request came into the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Department. An assistant asked her what to do with all of the police reports.
I wasn't aware that we had this problem. It was my belief that the kits were being turned in and they were being tested by the APD crime lab. That's what I had thought this entire time.
Taylor's been the commander for the Criminal Investigations Division of the department for a little over a year. 60 detectives, 8 sergeants, and 3 lieutenants report to her.
What I did is I took on 488 reports, and we have a war room in the back here. There is a huge pile of reports.
Some of them date back to the 80s, but some of them are pretty new, too, Taylor says. She started poring over each police report that was associated with an untested evidence kit from Bernalillo County one by one.
It's hard. It's funny. I just kind of welled up with tears a little bit. It's very hard to read some of these cases because it's absolutely disgusting. And I have survivors in my family.
Taylor is sorting them into categories. The most urgent pile includes recent assaults, where survivors aren't sure who attacked them and where DNA might crack the case. The DNA is also entered into a national database. Taylor says the FBI has agreed to analyze 30 kits from Bernalillo County in March.
We are going to do our absolute best to bring closure to these cases and to figure this mess out and to get results from these kits.
When a new kit comes in, Taylor now gives it the same priority as a homicide and orders it to be driven to the lab in Santa Fe. That's because at the Albuquerque lab, the only other place in New Mexico where kits are tested, the so-called backlog is thousands deep. One of the biggest problems, Taylor says, is money. Money for advocates to reach out to survivors, money for the labs, money for detectives to investigate these cases, money to run trials and prosecute offenders. Not to mention that the cost of testing one kit at the state lab is between $400 and $500.
Listen, anything is better than nothing. I'm at the point now where I'm ready to go have a bake sale to raise money to test these kits.
Taylor also rewrote a vague 3-sentence policy about what detectives are supposed to do with sexual assault evidence. Only about 1/5 of law enforcement departments in New Mexico have a written policy, according to a statewide audit. Connie Monahan of the New Mexico Coalition of Sexual Assault Programs has been leading the charge on getting kits sent to the labs to be tested for years.
Law enforcement agencies, there is no way they could not have been aware of the growing pile of brown bags and white envelopes in a corner of their evidence rooms.
There's even a law on the books in New Mexico that says when a police report is filed about a sexual assault and there's an evidence kit, it has to be tested.
Where we are now was totally preventable if people had followed the law. But you can't just have a law. You have to have the policy that says when you are delivering the samples, you'll do it within X number of days, the time, the process, you'll have this form filled out.
The policies are lacking, Monahan says, and that leaves the decisions about evidence up to individual officers, which can be a problem if a detective doesn't believe the victim. The audit found that was one common reason kits aren't sent for testing.
Why do we allow one person to have that amount of power and judgment in determining what happens next?
Monahan's helped bring about a mandatory hour of training on biological evidence and sexual assault for every officer in the state. She says they've got to start convincing officers that testing the DNA in these kits and logging it into the national database is important. It's how serial rapists are caught all over the country and right here at home. Then it's up to the state's prosecutors to get a conviction. Reporting from Albuquerque, I'm Marisa DeMarco.
Coming up on Fronteras, the Mexican side of the border fence below California is now a canvas for artists of all kinds.
So we're here as gathered together as a community to paint and really make this wall stand out and turn it into something beautiful and positive rather than the negative image that it is.
We'll explore that story and the benefits of mutualistas after this. I'm Norma Martinez, and this is Fronteras. If you're a lifelong Texan, you may have heard of a mutualista. These mutual aid societies were part of a long tradition in Mexico and found their way into Texas in the late 1800s. The organizations worked to provide low-income families with resources they otherwise might not have access to. While most disappeared in the 30s and 40s, throughout Texas today, there are still a small number in operation. Carlos Morales of KWBU Public Radio in Waco introduces us to one thriving community mutualista that's been around for more than 90 years.
Luis Fajardo opens the doors to La Mutualista Sociedad de Jornaleros.
Yeah, let me turn the lights on and see what I'm talking about.
Hanging on a concrete wall are black and white photos, memories of the organization's earliest days. Fajardo is a member and president of the group. He points to one specific photo.
In 1924, these gentlemen right here, on this particular day, under this tree, which still exists, are the ones that decided to make the Mutualista.
The Waco Mutualista came together under the banner of union, fraternity, and progress, with a specific interest in watching over the working-class community it came from. Its name even reflects that mission. In English, jornaleros means laborers. This idea, says University of Texas professor Emilio Zamora, is the main reason Mexicans that settled in Texas established these groups.
They had to develop new methods for survival and advancement, and one of them was the formation of organizations.
Across Texas, these groups provided services their community members were being denied, things like education and health care. Mutualistas also negotiated for better working conditions and created insurance funds to take care of members. That made a huge difference in quality of life, according to Ernesto Fraga. He publishes El Tiempo, Waco's local Hispanic newspaper, and his grandparents were some of the earliest members of Waco's Mutualista. Fraga says the Mutualistas also preserved culture.
And they were the ones that allowed for the voice of the Mexican-American community to pass on to the next generation and the generations after that.
Heading into the 1900s, the popularity of Mutualistas swelled, with more than 100 estimated to be in Texas. That boost, Zamora says, happened because at that time,
increasing numbers of Mexicans are brought in to fill the low-skilled occupations and low-wage occupations in the developing industries of the American Southwest, ranching, farming, the railroads, and mining.
But during the Great Depression, Mutualistas faced financial hardships, and many closed their doors. Today, there's about six still operating in Texas. Waco Mutualista President Luis Fajardo says finances are still a concern for these groups. But the one in Waco has, in part, been buoyed for decades by the dance hall they own and rent out for baptisms or quinceañeras, like this one. La Mutualista's dance hall can fit about 400 people. And tonight, it's packed with teenagers dancing to cumbias, little kids running around, and adults trying to talk to each other over the music. Nights like this one translate to money for the Mutualista, which Fajardo says they'll use to pay bills.
Then the other part is basically the funds that we take when we make a certain amount of money, and we'll say, okay, this is going to go into the scholarship fund, this is going to go here, this is going to go there.
On a recent afternoon, the Waco Mutualista hosted a Christmas gift giveaway. Part of the money Fajardo and the membership made this year went towards buying nearly $3,000 worth of toys, like dolls, trucks, and bikes, all given to neighborhood kids, like 2-year-old Arabella Chavez.
She just won a bike, and that's what she's been wanting.
That's Arabella's mom, Misty Chavez. She's a mother of five and knows volunteers here at the Mutualista.
Just having something like this, it's fun and it's exciting for them, especially if we ourselves can't, you know, afford to get them what they want or need.
Filling that gap is why Mutualistas were founded in the first place. Fajardo says even though the times have changed, La Mutualista Sociedad de Jornaleros' mission hasn't. And he's dedicated to making the Mutualista stronger.
I'll do whatever it takes, along with the membership, to open up and succeed for the Mutualista now and in the future.
In the new year, Fajardo says the Mutualista will continue with building improvements. They've already opened up the dance floor and updated light fixtures. They'll also look to encourage others to visit, people not just from their South Waco neighborhood, but the community at large. I'm Carlos Morales.
The fence along the U.S.-Mexico border, south of San Diego, is getting a facelift. Tijuana muralist Enrique Chu is leading a binational effort to create a mural that will stretch for more than 1 mile on the south side of the border fence. Jean Guerrero of KPBS reports that would make it one of Mexico's longest murals.
Enrique Chu brings together volunteers from both the U.S. and Mexico to paint the border fence every weekend. He wants to make the fence colorful and inspiring. He says the original border fence, with its plain steel, is ugly.
It was a rusty wall, a wall full of, I don't know, apathy, sadness. For years, it was seen as something that divides.
He started the project in December. It's called El Mural de la Hermandad, the Mural of Brotherhood and Sisterhood.
We want to send a message of peace, of kinship, of unity between the two nations.
Anyone can come paint the wall with Chu, professional artists, families, even children.
If someone doesn't know what to paint, I help them. If they don't have an image in mind, maybe a message such as love and peace.
Chu's only rule is that the images must be happy. When it's done, Chu says the mural will be one of the longest in Mexico, stretching about a mile and a quarter. Chula Vista illustrator Michelle Ruby Guerrero was one of the artists at the fence.
So we're here as gathered together as a community to paint and really make this wall stand out and turn it into something beautiful and positive rather than the negative image that it is.
She says her painting stands for love and enlightenment. Chu says he's not worried about President-elect Donald Trump's plans to replace the fence with a tall wall.
If they build a wall, it's more canvas for us. We'll paint that too.
Chu says the artist will paint every weekend through April 2nd. For Fronteras, I'm Jean Guerrero in San Diego.
And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. We're glad you can join us. I'm Norma Martinez for Texas Public Radio.